think it's recorded.
This morning, I want to look at a chapter in the book of Genesis. And on the surface, this chapter may look like it's either out of place or there may not be much to it, but I think there's a lot more to it than we would give it on the surface. And I think to illustrate what I'm trying to get at, it's important to remember Genesis is a book, but it's divided into 11 sections. Each section starts with a phrase, something to the effect of, depending upon your translation, these are the generations of, or this is the genealogy of the generations of an individual. There is one exception. The very beginning of the book doesn't start that way. It starts with in the beginning, or the name of the book, Genesis. But all the rest of the sections are about the generations or genealogy of a person. The last section, that person, is Jacob, or Israel. In chapter 37 of Genesis, we kind of start in the story of Jacob. We start looking at Joseph. And starting in verse 37, through the rest of the book, really, we are evaluating Joseph, or learning about Joseph, except in chapter 38 and chapter 49. 49, we learn some things about Joseph, but all of the sons are included in chapter 49. So this is not the story of Joseph, though. It's the story of Jacob and his sons. And so here in chapter 38, we're going to shift the focus from Joseph, which we read about in chapter 37, his brothers selling him. He gets sold in Egypt. And now we're going to shift back to Canaan and look at Judah. And I think this story here is important, for one, because God put it here. But I think it's also important for a whole host of other reasons. One of those reasons is it gives us a feel for just how long Joseph was in Egypt. We're going to read about Judah leaving the family. We don't know if this was amiable or not, but the thought is maybe there was something that arose that caused him to leave because of the wording that's used here. But he left the family for a long time. Long enough to get a wife, long enough to have three sons, long enough for those three sons to get old enough to marry, and then he conceives with his daughter-in-law two boys. So this is a long period of time that transpires while Joseph is in Egypt before the family goes to meet Joseph in Egypt. And so this is happening from that time that Joseph is sold until Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to get food. This is occurring in that time frame. There are a whole host of other things that we can get out of this that I want to point out as we go through them. But something to remember as we go through this story. From the beginning of God's interaction with man, not the first, but one of the first commandments he gave was be fruitful and multiply. But he's also given promises that he will multiply. And that thought is, throughout the book of Genesis, the thought is this multiplying is an act of two parties, human and divine. There's the physical act that humans do to multiply, but it has to be graced by the divine, God. Sarah and Abraham are promised a son years, 25 or more years, before they actually have a son. And that's because God allowed that to happen. Same thing with Isaac. 40 years Isaac and Rebekah lived, not having twins. Finally, God allowed that to happen. Jacob with Rachel. So we see this, and I think that's important to remember when we approach this story because of some of the things that happen in this. Then right before we get into this, and there are six sections, and we'll kind of go through each section individually. But if you remember in the previous chapter, when the brothers throw Joseph into the pit, Reuben suggested that rather than killing him, because we're told his motivation was to go free him. But then Reuben's plan is thwarted because one of the other brothers says, let's sell him. And this seems to be a negative thing on that brother. That brother is actually Judah. Judah suggests the selling of him. We don't know exactly what his motivation was, but at the least it was to gain money or profit from his brother. There's another thought that maybe he was guaranteeing that his brother would not somehow escape and tell his dad what had happened. And so he's ensuring that by selling him, getting money, and getting him out of that area. So far, Jude has been presented either in a neutral light or in the last chapter in somewhat of a negative light. So he's kind of a callous individual. And I think at least the first part of this chapter, we're going to see that reinforced just in some comparisons that are naturally drawn to his actions and what he does. So let's read the first five verses of this chapter. And this is kind of a setting scene, if you will, for the rest of the chapter. It tells us about him leaving the family and establishing his own in the land of Canaan. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there his daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son. He named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Chezeb that she bore him. So here we see Judah leaving the family, going up to Canaan. My version uses the word visited. It literally means turned aside. That's implying a more, in the original Hebrew, the implication is it wasn't a vacation. It was more of a permanent move, a relocation on his part. He was going to be with Hira, not with his father and his brothers. He had relocated to this area. And so it seems like that for whatever reason, Judah has left the family. Then the next verse, we're introduced to a woman. Now, there are a couple things about this woman that we are not told. One of them is we're not told her name. We are told, however, her father's name. So Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. Now, this took her and went into her can legitimately mean marrying, but it could also mean something less than that, maybe fornication involved. And I'm not saying that that was involved here, but the fact that it uses took followed by went into, later on she is called his wife. And so the thought is that maybe this marriage was not based solely, or maybe at all, in love. Maybe it was a little more lust that caused this relationship. Especially when you see the follow-up, verb after verb after verb, three sons being born. So she conceived, bore, and then named. She conceived, bore, named. She bore still another son. So those verbs suggest a couple of things. They happen in quick succession, so it's not that they all happened at the same time, but probably within 5 years, we have three sons being born to him. And the fact that this happened so soon after he meets her suggests again that maybe there was more of a physical relationship here than emotional. I'm not saying there was not an emotional, it just seems like the focus on this story is more on the physicality of that relationship. Especially given that we're not even told her name. So, another thing to think about here is thus far, since God has established the covenant with Abraham, it has been a negative thing. A thing to actively work against, to marry somebody from Canaan. Abraham made his servant swear by grabbing his thigh and saying, I will not find a wife for Isaac from Canaan. I will find one from your family. And sent him to find her. After Esau marries two women from the land of Canaan, Isaac sends Jacob away to find a wife. He finds two, Leah and Rachel. But they are from the family. And so at least it's not forbidden yet that we are aware of. In the law of Moses it will be. But it seems like within this family, marrying in the land of Canaan is frowned upon. Yet Judah does that. She's definitely labeled a Canaanite. Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And so he took this non-Israelite, non-family member to start his family and then has three sons born, what appears to be rather close together. So let's read verses 6 through 11 then. We're going to be introduced to yet another female, and we are given her name, and she's kind of the focal point of this story along with Judah. So reading 6 through 11. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went to his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So here we see Tamar being given to two of his sons and promised to his third son by Judah. What's interesting about Ur, and it seems like there's a pun here that we don't necessarily see in English, but the word for evil in Hebrew is the same as the word for Ur backwards. So it's kind of Ur, but then backwards Ur is the word for evil. And so with that being a pun, it'd almost be like in English, we would say Ur erred. He erred, God took his life. So it seems like there's some kind of pun with Ur and evil and the fact that God thought that he was so evil that he ended his life. We're not told what he did that was evil. We're just told that he was evil. God then took his life. And it looks like Judah responded rapidly, maybe immediately. He told his next born son, Onan, that it was his responsibility to bring up offspring for his brother. This may have been a custom, more than likely. But if you also think about the fact that God promised Abraham that he would multiply him into a great nation, the actions after that by Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now his 12 sons are all to lead to that multiplication. Remember, multiplying is an act that God promises, but it cannot be accomplished without the human act as well. And so, and it seems like this is being implied here. In verses 8 and 9, three times, my version uses the word offspring, but it's talking about descendants. Three times, and repetition in the Old Testament means something that we should look at. So verse 8, then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law and raise up offspring for your brother." Onan knew that his offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. So I think that's trying to draw our attention to the fact that the action that's being accomplished here is the will of God for this multiplying of the family of Abraham. Onan does not want to be part of the human portion of this two-party system to have offspring. He goes through some of the physical actions of it, but does things to prevent that from coming to fruition. He frustrates, apparently, the will of God. What worse situation would you want to be found in than frustrating God's will from being accomplished? Onan did just that, and we see what it brought him. Physical death. Verse 10, but what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. The Lord took Ur's life, now the Lord's taken Onan's life. One last thing to think about here is, in our version, in English, it sounds like this happened one time. Judah said, go into her. He did. It didn't work. And it's over. In Hebrew, this is a repetition thing. It's plurality of events. So this is something that Onan probably did a few or maybe several times. And God is very displeased to the point that he then takes his life. Now, we don't know the ages of Onan, or Shelah. But it seems like Shelah's age is right on that cusp of where he may be old enough to marry, but he also may be young enough to where he wouldn't be expected to marry. Because it seems like Tamar has some kind of expectation that she's going to get Shelah. So he's not so young that she would not have that expectation. She kind of, it seems like she has this expectation she should get Shelah. But Judah uses the excuse, he's too young. And that is acceptable to Tamar because she agrees with it apparently and leaves to go live with her father. So that age, we don't know, but it might be somewhere between 13 and 16 years of age. It may not be, but it seems like that might be about the time frame that we're talking about here for Shelah. So Judah then promises Tamar to his youngest son, Shelah, but wants that to be fulfilled in the future. He's made a promise. Okay? And I think that's important to remember. Judah's made his first promise in this chapter. He's going to make a second promise. Ironically, to Tamar, he just doesn't know it. Okay? And that's going to happen in our next reading. So, starting in verse 12, and let's read through verse 19. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, so he covered her, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Hear now, let me come into you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He said, "Therefore I will give you a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She said, "Your seal, your cord, your staff, that is in your hand." So she gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. And so here we see Tamar after some time, and again, we're not told in verse 12 how much time that is, but it's long enough for Shelah to have gotten to the age where Tamar had a legitimate expectation to have been given to her, given to him already. And so she takes some actions here, and it may not be entirely clear why she did it, and I'm not sure I completely understand it, but it does seem like in the story, at least, if you're remembering, we're trying to multiply the descendants of Abraham. The only one in this story who seems to be interested in doing that is Tamar, who's not even a Jew. She's a Canaanite. And she's the only one that's doing anything. I'm not saying her motive was this, but she's the only one taking action to actually do what God had promised to Abraham. A couple of things about this section that we learn that I think fortify our negative opinion of Judah is, one is, we're told right at the beginning of verse 12, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. When the time of mourning was ended, we're not told he mourned. I'm not saying he didn't, but if he did, it only lasted for the prescribed time. Probably not longer than 30 days, probably not shorter than a week to 10 days. So somewhere in that time frame, at the end of that time, he immediately goes off to party. That's not how it says it. It says, when the time of mourning had ended, Judah went up to his sheep shears at Timnah. But we know that sheep shearing was a major event. There was work involved, but it was also a very much party atmosphere. Alcohol was usually involved at the time of sheep shearing. He goes up to do this. So we can contrast here, indirectly, with the last time we read about Jacob. Jacob is inconsolably mourning the loss of Joseph. Judah, who lost his wife, as soon as the days of mourning are over, leaves to go do business and have a good time. That's indirect. There's also a direct contrast. What does Tamar do when she learns about this? She removes her widow's clothing. She's still in mourning. Judah's not. Tamar's been in mourning a lot longer than Judah. Judah's not even in mourning. And so it seems like he's this callous individual. He's going up to do this. And so Tamar then is told about this. And the other thing to remember is we don't know how involved Hira was in this, but it seems like he was traveling with Judah when all of these things happened. He definitely plays a role after this section as well in trying to fulfill his promise. But so far, up until this section, Tamar's been a passive object. She's been acted upon. She's been given to Ur. She's been given to Onam. She's been promised to Shelah. Now she's taking action herself. She's an active participant in what we see going on. And from verse 14, it seems clear that an injustice has been done to her, because it says, she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. And so she takes this purposeful, deliberate action. What, again, in a contrast here, Judah kind of takes the bite. His sexual appetite kind of wins out over him. He doesn't want to delay his fulfillment. This dialogue between him and Tamar, discussing the terms of their action, is the longest dialogue in this chapter, and it seems like it's very quick and to the point. I want this. What do you give me? I'll give you this. How are you going to guarantee I get it? This is how I'm going to do it. The action's done. So it's kind of pointed. He's very much in business mode of getting what he wants from what he believes to be a prostitute. Now, verse 16 makes it clear that he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. But the things that she asks for as a promissory note, remember, he promises her a kid, but he doesn't have this goat with him. So she says, how are you going to guarantee that I'm going to get this? So he says, what should I give you? And she says, a seal, cords, and a staff. These are very personable items. A seal, we don't know exactly what kind of seal. It could have been a ring, signet ring, or it could have been a rounded seal that they used. But it was not exactly like, but it could be considered analogous to maybe a credit card today. And so this is a personal thing of his, this seal that she's asking for. Cords were worn around the neck. Usually the seal had a hole in it and worn on those cords. And while the staff was something that was practical, apparently Judah has a place of authority that his staff would have signified that authority. And so she's asking for his authority piece, his staff, his credit card, if you will, in his seal, and the cords that hold that. And that's what he gives her as his promise that he will deliver the kid to her once he gets to the place where he can do that. So she gets these things, she's happy with that, and then we see what transpires. Judah now is displayed. Remember, he's now made two promises, right? He's promised Tamar, daughter-in-law, that she will have his youngest son as her husband. He's promised Tamar, prostitute, in his mind, I'm not saying she was acting like it, or at least looked like it, that he would give her a goat. He's now going to try to fulfill one of those promises to Tamar in verses 20 through 23. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim? And they said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. And so here, he's more interested in fulfilling a promise he made to somebody he believes to be a prostitute than he is to his daughter-in-law. And he's acting on that. He sends this goat. And it seems like prostitution was legal, but maybe there were at least some components of it that were disgraceful. The fact that he sends his friend, Hira, I'm really butchering that name now, Hira, to do this instead of himself doing it would seem to indicate that he was a little embarrassed by this thing that had happened. So he sends Hira to do this. And then, at the very end, when Hira comes back and says, I couldn't find her, and I asked about her, and they said, there hasn't been anybody like her around here. And Judah says, let's just drop it. Let's cover this up. Why? He's afraid of being embarrassed. We are going to become a laughingstock, is what he says in verse 23. So, that's what's happened. Now we're getting to the climax of the story. We see what's happened with Judah, his family, and now his relationship with his daughter-in-law. And now we're getting to the crux of what these events are really being told to us about. Let's read verses 24 through 26. Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she's with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I'm with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and she did not have relations, and he did not have relations with her again. And so here we see, and I think this is the pivotal part. Thus far, everything about Judah that we've read has been negative. This ends with Judah being portrayed positively. And so we see this transformation. It all happens because of the actions of his daughter-in-law. But he's told, your daughter has played the harlot. You know, or literally, I think it means been promiscuous. But she's pregnant as a result of this. Now, she had been promised to Shelah. There was no doubt in anybody's mind she had no business with anybody other than Shelah, even by their customs from them back then. And so Judah does have the right to pronounce a judgment on her and even a sentence because Tamar had been promised to his son and now apparently has illegitimately conceived. But it seems like Judah does this to the harshest position that he can. You know, he says, bring her out and let her be burned. This seems pretty extreme. And I understand the law of Moses is not in place yet. That happens in Exodus several hundred years later. But under the law of Exodus, burning would not have been the sentence. Death would have been the sentence, but not by burning, by stoning. Burning seems more intense. Burning was the sentence for adultery under the law of Moses if it was a priest's daughter. So it seems to intensify if it's a priest's daughter doing adultery versus a common Israelite, then the sentence is burning. Judah goes right to the burning. His daughter-in-law sinned, let her be burned. Kill her, burn her. He hasn't even talked to her yet. Well, while they're bringing her to him, she sends his stuff back to him. This is where it really gets interesting. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I'm with child by the man who these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring these things are. That please examine and see is almost word for word what Judah and his brothers said to Jacob when they returned with Joseph's coat and goat's blood on it. Examine this and see if this is not your son's. So now we see three times the lineage of Abraham has had deception within the family. Jacob deceives his father, Isaac, to get the blessing. Jacob's deceived by his sons about Joseph when they sold him into slavery. Now we see Tamar deceiving Judah, who had deceived his father, who had deceived his father, by playing like she was a harlot. So we see this trifold deception that is occurring. This is just an interesting note. I don't know if there's anything to it. But in all three of those deceptions, goat and an article of clothing are involved. And so there's this trifold deception that we now have within this family, and Tamar is doing this to get Judah to realize the position she has been placed in by him. Look at almost the immediate turnaround of Judah. Verse 24, bring her out and let her be burned. Verse 26, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I. He does two things by saying that. She is not guilty of what I thought she was guilty of. She is innocent. He proclaims her innocent. But at the same time, he proclaims himself guilty. So he recognizes his error and proclaims that out loud at the same time that he's declaring his daughter-in-law innocent. And he tells why. She's more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. So that kind of ends the story, but it's not completely over. And I just take a short time to look at the final section of this chapter, verses 27 through 30. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So here we have the two sons of Judah being born in this exact same fashion that Jacob and Esau were born. I don't think that's a coincidence. What's ironic about both of these situations is that Jacob, labeled the second born, is the chosen one of God. Perez, labeled the second one born, is the chosen one of God. And this is another reason why I think this story is important. The next time we read about Judah, he's back in Canaan with his father. And he is tenderly, passionately pleading with his father to release his father's most beloved son that's alive, Benjamin, and telling him he will be surety for Benjamin. After selling his beloved son, Joseph, he's now completely opposite. I will make sure that nothing happens to him to the point that I will bear whatever happens to him. That's what he tells Jacob. Something turned him around, and I think it's at least initiated by this chapter, this event with Tamar, corresponding with the deaths of his sons, and his wife may have helped with that as well. But further than that even, when we get to chapter 49, your chapter may say the blessings of Jacob. I don't like that word, because the first three sons that Jacob talks to or about in that chapter, he does not bless them. He curses them. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. Judah, the fourth born to Jacob, the last to Leah before there's a pause, and then Leah has two more after him, but there's a pause. Judah's that fourth one. Judah is the first one that he blesses. He blesses Judah more than any of the other sons. You will not die till the scepter shall not pass from you until Shiloh comes. Messianic prophecy to Judah. God's chosen one was Judah. God was prophesying through Jacob that Judah would be the beholden, promised one that the Messiah is going to come through. What tribe was Jesus born to? Judah. What family? Perez. Twin son of Judah. Perez is chosen as the lineage of Christ. Perez, born out of an act of prostitution, is part of the lineage of David and of Christ. It gets deeper than that. If you go to the wall, there is a harlot who becomes, a direct harlot who becomes in the lineage of David and Christ as well. So I think there are a lot of things we can draw from that, but one of them is, from a human perspective, this story probably would not have been written the way it is. We would want the Son of God to have a perfect lineage, always the firstborn, always the righteous one. But that's not what we see. We're told the bruises and bangs that this plan takes, but it's God's plan, and that's all that matters. And I think for us today, we can take from that that God has a plan. He had a plan then. He had a plan, and his plan is being enacted by Judah and his brothers and Jacob and Joseph and their descendants. That plan is part of God's plan to cleanse man from sin. From the very beginning of this book, Genesis, when sin entered the world, God had initiated a plan that allowed man to not be in that condition of sin. And we see the fulfillment through Judah, his twin son Perez, in Christ. Christ is the eminence of God's plan. And it's because of Christ that we can have a relationship with God that's free of sin. Not that we are free of sin, but that the relationship can be free of sin because if the sin that we have has been washed away by the blood of Christ. If you've had your sins washed away, but you've not lived your life the way you should change your life. You need to change your life. If you need to do that in a public way, I encourage you to do that. If you've never accepted Christ as your Savior, had your sins washed away, you need that even more. You need to have those sins washed away by being buried with Him in baptism. If you know that you need to do that, then I encourage you to do that as well as we stand and sing the invitation song.